wolf on the hill is never as hungry as the wolf climbing.
Lone wolf is a term commonly used by many people. It means that they used to belong to a group, but left to become stronger. By thinking and acting alone, the lone wolf acquires superior cunning, agility, imagination, and skills unknown to members of the pack. The lone wolf is independent of and distances itself from the petty bickerings, expectations, demands, mediocrities, and unfulfilled dreams of other people, groups, or organizations. The lone wolf is often branded as the rebel.
For it is the sovereign lone wolf who stands alone in all of his or her glory. You are listening to Lone Wolf Radio, presented and hosted by Tom Metzger. Tom is now broadcasting from a newly relocated and improved bunker in an undisclosed location with internet access across the globe. So sit back, relax, and enjoy another episode on Lone Wolf Radio.
Thank you, sir. Well, as representative of the White American Political Association, I'm very happy to be here today. We almost were late. We almost went to the wrong high school. But anyhow, the history of the White American Political Association, it was begun in 1980, created in 1980 after I ran for Congress on the Democratic ticket here in the local area. It was decided at that time that we needed a broad-based, white-oriented organization working politically for the best interests of white people, specifically middle and low-income whites, to run people for office, to get people involved in local politics, and to carry the fight for what we perceive as a group of people in the United States who have lost their identity. Not to be confused with fat cat organizations that do a very good job at representing wealthy whites. And not to be confused with organizations such as the Mexican American Political Association, which works for the best interests of Mexicans. That's very good, Mexican Americans. the Black American Political Association works very well for the black citizens of the state of California. So we have evened up the score just a little bit with the White American Political Association. And since 1980, we have been developing organizations throughout the state of California, and for that matter around the United States, but primarily here in California. The White American Political Association has now become a part of an overall organization we call WAR, White American Resistance. The White American Resistance is an organization that is putting a little more teeth into what we're trying to get across, and also be an umbrella organization including representatives from all white racialist groups around the United States, and for that matter we have international contacts with organizations in Europe and around the world. So, the White American Political Association is just what we say it is. It works politically. It is a free-thinking organization. We have monthly meetings in various places around the state of California. It's a white man's, Caucasian's, free-thinking type organization. We adhere to no religious creed one way or the other. We have Christians, we have atheists, we have agnostics. We don't quibble over religion. We have socialists, we have free enterprisers, we have all kinds of political ideology in the White American Political Association, and we debate the issues of the day, trying to come up with plans for the best interests of rank-and-file white people. And here again, I'm talking about primarily middle- and low-income white people. This has been very effective. Maybe I'd better go back to a little bit about my background. I'm originally from Indiana. I've been in California for many years, since 1961. And I started out as what I would call a classic liberal as far as my ideology when I was your age and younger. Very much a very, very liberal on many things, and I still am within the context of the white race quite liberal today, as you'll find as we go along. I gradually became interested in the right-wing movement in the United States, the so-called anti-communist movement, and became quite active in that for several years and was primarily conservative-oriented. I began to see that the conservative movement in the United States was only half a thing, because our equal and opposite enemy was not only communism, but capitalism. Monopoly capitalism was probably even a worse enemy than communism, because we had found historically that communism was created and financed and bankrolled from the very beginning by very rich people, capitalists, and continue to do that today, even up to the day when the United States finances and loans the tremendous amounts of money to Russia, while we are told, and young people are told, to go fight wars to stop communism. So at that point, I became disillusioned with the straight conservative line, did investigate the libertarian idea for some time, and still have all of these areas. There are good points and bad points, and the libertarians have a lot of good points, but they have what I consider to be fatal points, being too much like a religion, becoming a faith, to where in belief that the state will wither away, or we don't need government. Well, whether we need government or whether we do not need government, I can assure you there will be some form of state or government as long as man walks on this earth. Because it just seems to be that many people depend on a hierarchy of a government of some kind, and there's always people that are willing to fulfill that position. Sometimes for good and sometimes for bad. So I have sympathy with libertarian ideas of the government staying off people's backs as much as possible, but I cannot go along with a religious type idea of libertarianism. Karl Marx had this idea that the state would wither away, and of course this is ridiculous. So states do commit suicide, but they never wither away, or they're overthrown by force. Then I became a tax rebel and refused to pay my income taxes during the Vietnam War, deciding that not only Was it ridiculous that we had better fight communism by withdrawing aid to Russia and all these communist countries that we were financing, and the big boys were making money doing it? But also, the Vietnam War was a travesty, and no one intended to win it. That situation in the first place, the government of the United States did not intend to win that war, so they were needlessly throwing American people into this thing and being really killed for nothing. They died for absolutely nothing. Anyone in the United States today that believes that, unfortunately, that these people stopped communism, or the United States has ever stopped communism, is a fallacy. We have communism just as strong today as it ever was. So obviously we're doing something wrong. I was hounded by the IRS. I've had treasury agents all over my property. I've had my home seized a couple of times. But I didn't give in to the IRS because, especially at that time under the Nixon regime, it was a tremendously oppressive outfit. They still are today, but they're not quite as bad. So on civil disobedience and things like this, I cut my teeth in a tax rebellion. I was thrown out of the John Birch Society, which was a right-wing anti-communist organization, because I said, well, let's quit reading books and take this thing into our hands and be active and do something. If you don't like the way your government's running, don't finance it. If you're financing something and you don't like the way it's financed, don't finance it. Stop it. So I quit cold turkey for about 4 years paying income tax. But then I saw that the income tax rebel movement was being undermined by people who, in a lot of cases, were just trying to get out of it to cheat, and people who were just in it to make a lot of money giving speeches. So I became disenchanted with that, even though I had a high regard. And it could have brought this government back in shape if it would have grown large enough. At that time, I became interested in the racial situation. It had been actually earlier than that. And started working with a young man from Louisiana by the name of David Duke. At that time, he was 20 years old and the leader of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, graduate of University of Louisiana. And I was very impressed because he articulated that really, white middle class and white economically deprived people in the United States were in a scissors hole between the capitalists and the communists, and we needed to break out of this, and we needed to break out of the conservative movement, even though not everything that conservatives say we disagree with, but we believe that the conservative movement in the United States is just a loyal opposition that sort of goes along with big money, and are very concerned with the well-being of white rich people who can build giant walls around their houses and have police to guard them, but have no concern whatever for the rest of their race. And these people, in turn, that are entrenched in these positions, want to use non-white races of people, as they always have, for cheap labor, and guise that with humanitarianism. These people are not humanitarianism, and unfortunately have to do with writing a lot of the books that you read that they guise simple greed behind humanitarianism. The powers and the movers in the economic world do not care about black people, white people, Asian people, or anyone else. They care about profits. So I was active as a leader in the KKK for some time. Real active up until 1980, and I was the leader of the Klan here in California. And the idea that Mr. Duke and I had and other younger people around the country was to create a broad-based, politically strong, no-nonsense organization to combat both wings, the communists, the capitalists in this country. We found that after a certain point that this, due to the nature of the Klan, was not possible. The Klan has to be what it always was, a secret guerrilla, paramilitary, oath-taking organization. And it continues to be that today. It's all over the United States. And the only Klan that you really see on the TV today are what we call the Hollywood Klan. They take 10 guys and put sheets on them, parade them out in front of a government building. The communists or left wing or whoever comes out, they throw a few rocks. The police whisk them away, and that's the perception of what the Klan is. And I want to tell you right now that that is not what the Klan is. The Klan is very deep-seated. Many people in fairly important places supplying information for other white people around the country, sometimes people in government, sometimes teachers, sometimes students, and so forth. But you'll see less and less about the Klan because it has returned to its original precept. And the Klan, if need be, will do what it had to do in the original days when white people were being disenfranchised and the rich southern white oligarchy was throwing the working class whites to the dogs during Reconstruction and selling out to northern bankers and industrialists. But anyhow, I and others saw that we definitely needed a broad-based, open-style organization, and that's how WAPA came about. There's no secrets, no oaths, no uniforms, nobody's hiding. We're right out in the open. Anyone who wants to talk to me can call me or come up to Fallbrook. People of any persuasion can come to our meetings. And as long as they maintain a rational position and don't try to tear up the place, they're welcome. We believe this has been quite successful. Over the years, I have developed a number of young leaders across the state and across the United States. Mr. Burbage here, who is the director of the San Diego County operation, is one of those young men who was 16 when I first met him, and we've been working together ever since. He's in his 20s now, and he has married a young gal who is also in the what we would consider the movement. We have recruited a lot of college young people up and down the state over the years. My Northern California organizer and director was recruited when he was about 20, and now he's about 26, and he handles all operations in Northern California. In the Sacramento area, a man by the name of Greg Withrow is our state white student leader who is in charge of helping to organize white student clubs on campuses of not only high schools, but colleges across the state. He has been fighting very hard in the Sacramento area with the American River College administration, who seem to say it's all right to have black classes and black clubs, Mexican, Asian, homosexual, you name it, but they would not allow a white studies or white pride type organization, which doesn't quite sound like equality to me. I thought that's what they were going for, was equality. Our basic position is that we do not believe in equality. In fact, equality is such a myth that no rational person that's really educated him or herself with volumes of material that's available will believe that equality is either achievable or desirable. Many men have argued the case of inequality, not only between races, but between people of the same race. You wouldn't want to live in an equal, totally equal world. I think you saw that in the movie, maybe The Wall, where the kids were coming off the conveyor belt. They were equal. People like Ashley Montague, who took the position of the egalitarian position of equality, has argued for years that everyone's equal and it's all just your environment. So that gives everyone who's not doing too well an excuse that they don't have a lot of money, or if they don't live in the right neighborhood, or if they don't happen to go to the right school, then that's their excuse for failure. Well, that can be a mutant. That can have a certain effect, but it is not the basic cause. Our position is genetic, and that the idea of genetics determining to a large degree your future is becoming more and more back in vogue after being suppressed for some time. Dr. Dwight Ingalls from the University of Texas, there's several hours of debate which you probably have never heard, and I doubt whether any high school or college, or at least high school kids in the state of California has ever heard these debates, because you are totally snowed with the idea we must have equality, all we have to do is figure out how to get it. See, the original myth is that equality is correct and is possible. Recently, a newspaper article in San Diego came out talking about a professor now who's written a book about the findings of Margaret Mead. How many of you here know Margaret Mead or heard about her?
We will talk about her.
All right. Ashley Montague. Well, at the turn of the century, the international socialists, along with their capitalist financiers, decided they needed a concept of race to fit in with their economic concepts. And so a man by the name of Franz Boas, a geography professor from Germany, came to the United States and was paraded around the country as this genius who has decided that everything is because of your environment and genetics has nothing to do with it. Out of that, they were very popular with the politicians because that's what they were trying to get across, to make docile workers and so forth. And so the mentors of Franz Boas was Ashley Montague and Margaret Mead. Well, now it's beginning to come out. A book was written. She went to Samoa in 1923 and wrote her thesis that really it was just the industrial society that caused everybody to be messed up, and we wouldn't have any of these hang-ups if our environment was like the Samoans, because the Samoans had free love and everything was fine, no problems, no hang-ups, and so forth. In restudying this now, this book is coming out to show this is totally untrue. The highest murder rate, among the highest murder rate in the world, is in Samoa. They have a virginity cult in Samoa that is probably more wild than any place under Anglo-Saxon rule. And all these things that Margaret Mead put out and used to propagandize liberal elements of this country during her lifetime are coming down like a house of cards. And scientific journals more and more now are going back to the idea it's in the genetics. Now, that doesn't mean that a person who has a somewhat lower IQ can have a lot of ambition, overcome obstacles. But it does mean, in general, that genetics and IQ have a tremendous amount to do with the advancement of races and of individuals. Well, we have a tremendous amount of books and things that we distribute along these lines. However, if you don't see them in your high school library, you ought to ask yourself why. I have tried in many cases to get books on our side of the fence into schools, and it's almost like a total war to get them in. And these are books written by geneticists, anthropologists. You even have a great man here in the Escondido area, Dr. Graham, who is working with the sperm bank idea, and they're trying to make him look like a fool. And even though I'm not well acquainted with Dr. Graham, I have a lot of respect for people who believe in eugenics as opposed to dysgenics. I believe in the upgrading of the race as much as I believe in upgrading of individuals. But the main problem today is a society that is more bent on dysgenics than eugenics. And so people like Dr. Graham, the news media, try to make them, in many cases, look like fools. And he's really a courageous individual, and he's right here in your backyard. The White American Political Association in war does not support the draft. And we don't do that just to get a few young people to say, whoopee. We believe, after a careful analysis of World War I, World War II, Korea and Vietnam, none of these wars were good wars or had any positive benefit for white Americans, especially those that were not in position to make a lot of dough. So at this point in time, with the information that is available from revisionist historians on all of the rot, dirty crap that was going on, that most of the time you don't get in your history books, that went on behind the scenes of all these wars, we say it is time for white people to say no more. And we have a Well, like we have a bumper sticker here for the National Alliance, which is a group we associate with. No more war. Keep the United States out of the Mideast. The United States is shipping. Of course, the United States has become the big arms country of the world, giving arms to both sides everywhere, dumping tremendous amounts of arms in the Middle East, getting us ready for either a war there or South America next. And we're again. When President Reagan comes out and says, oh, Gaddafi, this terrible Gaddafi, I think he's up to something, and he sends ships into the Mediterranean, he sends planes to Egypt to spy on Libya, I say, I didn't elect this man for that stuff. Our territorial shores are not in Libya or Sudan. If the territorial areas of the United States are attacked or there is a threat to attack, we should take them with everything we have. But until such time, we should take care of our own business. And be, as our founding fathers said, be neutral and be a friend to all these nations and have quite a bit of dialogue between each other. It is not up to us to decide the type of governments they have. Internationally, the war organization is in contact with organizations like the League of St. George, the National Front in England, organizations in South Africa. Some of these organizations are becoming suppressed by the government. Australia, France, Belgium, the German Citizens Initiative in Germany, and even behind the Iron Curtain, we have contacts with white elements. A lot of people don't understand the Russian. People have a big problem with the tremendous Muslim and Asiatic birth rate in Russia, which threatens to push out the white Russians. And they're becoming almost as concerned about this biological and genetic war as they are about any problems with the United States. And I would hope we could move towards that type of situation and pull the plug on these nuclear weapons. I put the telephone number to our San Diego message phone, which we have a lot of thought-provoking and emotion-provoking messages on that the students are welcome to call. We have them all over the state of California, and we're at Box 65 in Fallbrook. And any questions you have, or any, if you're interested in a list of books that you might like to get a hold of and read, well, we can send that out to you. We can put you on a mailing list for our war publication that comes out every month. And we welcome your letters to the editors. You know, whether you like us or hate our guts, it doesn't make any difference. We're interested. So at that point, and I know there's probably something I've left out, I feel we can get down to the nitty-gritty better by questions and answers rather than a long monologue, because no matter how much I talk, I probably won't cover the issue that you want to ask. So, will you handle the appointment of who asked the question so I'm not accused of being prejudiced? Believe me, I've had that happen.
I know what you're saying about the North California schools that have the closing groups for all the other races, same white. What is the reasoning behind that?
I think they try to use arguments like it's disruptive. In other words, the rationale in the country today is, and I've had to confront it for several years, if I want to rent a hall and make a speech and invite people to come in and listen to what I have to say, and my opposition comes to the hall and breaks all the windows and burns the building down, I am somehow at fault because I wanted to say what I wanted to say. And this is what takes place. They say, well, if we allow this is going to cause the black clubs or other clubs to become very upset, or individuals, and it may cause violence. See, now how does, if you ever watched how Big Brother works, they're always going to protect you from violence. So the government says, like they did in Oceanside, when they pulled my permit for a hall just to make a speech, they used the excuse that we have been threatened by over 2,000 leftists, so-called leftists, for coming into Oceanside to tear down the town. And to that they cowered in and said, you can't have free speech. And so this is the excuse they use. The ACLU is working on it for our side. We have three or four other attorneys, and we've already succeeded in getting something done, but it's rough. Because on our side of the fence, there's not too much money. See, we scare the heck out of the big shots that have a lot of money, and we make the communist elements mad, And so we have a very narrow area of white working people and middle class to try to raise funds from. And so when we have a problem, we don't have 10 lawyers coming to our aid free, like most of these people do. The rich, of course, they can afford the best lawyers, and the communist elements, they always have 10 of these type of attorneys that come out to help them for free. So we're making headway, and what it takes is just stubborn individuals like Greg Withrow. He's a little red-headed fellow, and he's shorter than I am. This little fellow, he's 20 years old, and he's got the guts you wouldn't believe, and he goes up against about anybody up there, and he's been quite successful. But we have these people all over the state now. And gradually, we'll get them in.
I just saw a movie about Charles Manson, the Canadian Force Blast, and he was afraid the class would come up.
Well, as I understand it, Charles Manson said that his plan was to get the blacks excited. They were going to kill off all the whites, and then he and his little group were going to rule over the blacks. That was my understanding of what his theory was, which doesn't sound like he was very friendly to white people. And so we obviously don't go along with that kind of thing.
So with this thing of genetics, trying to make the race superior, isn't that like Hitler and his idea?
Well, I believe in what Dr. Shockley and Dr. Jansen have said at Stanford and these other schools. We're not saying that just white people should try to make yourself more and more intellectually superior, whatever you want to call it. We believe black people should do it too, but I'm not here to beat the drum for black people, because they've got hundreds of organizations and a lot of millionaires helping them out now, at least some of them, a little bit cynically, but they do it, you know. And the Mexican American Association, you know, they're getting a lot of money from Arco Gas Company and this MALDEF outfit. They're all funded. We're not funded, so I can't waste too much time on those people, but I believe Malcolm X believed in bringing those people up, and I believe that Marcus Garvey was one of the greatest black men as I can perceive as a white man, which I don't put myself in a position of judging black people, that's up to them. But Marcus Garvey did more for black people, or tried to, and to go for improving their not only their culture, but their genetics and so forth. So I think everyone should do it.
I have another question. How do you feel to all the people that
Well, everyone starts out this way. You know, you see, things get set in. You see, equality has become like a religion in the United States. And we got enough problems with religion. Get me on that, I'll spend some time with you, too. They've got this myth pushed into the people, and most people just sort of go along. You know as well as I do. I was asked on the radio the other day about, isn't it bad for kids to be rebellious? I said, no, it's good for kids to be rebellious as long as they're trying to find out something new and so forth, as long as they don't destroy themselves with drugs. I say the problem in this country is the older people are not rebellious enough. So I lost my line of thinking there.
Sorry.
Where was I don't think I finished the point. Oh, yes. Well, they come around. You see, I plant the seeds. I don't stand around on a street corner like Jehovah's Witness or something, grabbing people by the lapels. That is no way to get across any idea to anyone. We just make ourselves available. I talk to a lot of people. I'm the guest at a lot of schools. In the class, the information's available. I'm available to answer questions. There's a lot of other people who can answer even more heavier questions than I can. And so sometimes 3-4 years after I meet someone, they'll come up to me. Remember me? I was at this school and blah, blah, blah. I thought you were terrible, didn't agree with you at all, but I found you're just right. I had a fellow come in to me that was from Berkeley a few months ago. And he was into everything of the so-called left and all the what we call race mixing. Everything was wonderful, and all we had to do was that, and everything was going to be okay. And he said he was really totally absorbed in that. At one time, he'd have probably tried to kill me. But he said, all of a sudden, I found out when I said, well, hey, how about for white people within these groups? Everybody looked at him like he was a stranger. they got mad at him, wanted to throw him out. He said, wait a minute, we're talking about all this equal rights and everything. What about white people? And he began to see that this was a total fraud, that most of these people had no interest at all in the well-being of white people. So he made a 180-degree turn and changed his mind on all this. And he was one of the top students in his class there, and is a classical musician and so forth. So he went back out in the world to do his little bit. And so it happens all the time. I'm more interested in getting to young people, at least getting a foot in the door. You see, my opposition, they're afraid that I'm propagandizing you and brainwashing you, and these terrible ideas of mine are going to get you, and all this kind of stuff, which proves that they have absolutely no confidence in your intellect, basically. They think you're a bunch of little kids that can't rationalize and figure out who's reason. And if their ideas are so good, how come they're afraid? How come when you mention the non-equality of races, it becomes a total furor? They don't want you to speak, they try to get you off the stage and everything else. If it's such a stupid idea, and if it has no basis in fact, and if you can't document anything or prove anything, what are they afraid of? I believe that we should allow everything into the libraries. I have never been for excluding anything. If communists want to have a meeting, they should be able to rent the hall. If the capitalists want to have a meeting, they should be... The homosexuals, I don't care. If my ideas are better, my idea is going to prevail. So I'm not afraid of other ideas, because I find them wanting in many cases. And so I tend to be, whether people want to believe it, the more liberal of the element today. I go to a lot, our representatives are involved in all kinds of meetings. We go to a lot of government meetings, all this kind of stuff. And our minds change sometimes on certain things. We're very pragmatic about it. Politics is a luxury. Charles Lindbergh Jr., you might remember him who flew the ocean, and his father was a great man too. He said, politics is a luxury. The survival of the race is all important. Our bond with Europe is a bond of race. If the European race is ever attacked, we should go to war with all our planes and all our ships at sea to defend them. But we should not go to war with one white race, one white country against another. That was Charles Lindbergh, which you hear a lot about his flights, but you hear very little about the speeches he made to try to keep us out of World War II, which now you're paying for, your parents are paying for. They don't understand what's happening. The United States economically going down the tube. We're paying because we borrowed all that money to fight those wars. If you want to have a war, you got to pay for it. People say automatically, we'll just have a war. All these guns are free, you know. Somebody's got to pay for it. You got to pay for Vietnam economically. I paid for Korean World War II. People around World War I were still paying for Civil War. You want to have a war, you got to pay for it. Well, I'm just a little early. Our day, you see, some people, most people are in politics. The United States politics has degenerated to a terrible situation. Really, pretty much by the office. You look at who spends the most money in an election, and usually that person wins. Which is sort of sad to me, that the only way we can determine leadership is how many bucks the person has or is able to put together. And that is materialism at its very worst. People like myself do not go for the short run. We're looking, trying to look over the heads of people a little bit out in the future, trying to be leadership types, not looking behind us all the time to see how many people are following us. True leaders don't do that. If people are for you, they're going to go with you. If they're not, they're not. So we plan our roots out into the future. The future, we say, is moving towards us. The future is moving, the things that are going to be happening are moving away from this, what we would call jaded and poor operation that's going on in Washington now, because we virtually have no leadership. So I go out and I say what I think has to be said, and that's it. And if people like it, that's fine. If they don't like it, that's tough. But they're going to come around to most of my conclusions sooner or later, because
as the old hammer hits them on the anvil, they're going to get the message as time goes on. So if I have to win an election by prostituting my ideology, then I would not run. That is totally ridiculous. And unfortunately, that's why you don't get good leadership in this country, because people sell out their ideology because of money and raising money. You heard what Senator Hayek Hawa said when he retired. He said the most loathsome part of being in public office is going around and raising money, and the things you have to do, the things you have to say just to get a buck. This country cannot survive too many more decades of this kind of politics. And I hope that I will be a part, and I'm not trying to become king or dictator or cure or president or anything else. I'm trying to appeal to younger people, and other people of my age who are more educated than I, to come forward. Maybe something I can say will trigger somebody to really get in there and take a hold of this country, and I'll do everything I can do to support them. Well, the only reason I have ever run was to try, just like my opposition say, as a platform to get ideas out that have been forgotten in the art. See, on TV, they always have, well, this side and this side, the conservative and liberal arguments. To them, there's no other argument. I say a pox on both their houses, because I am not interested in conservatism or liberalism. I'm interested in any ideology that will bring the United States back or take it forward to something better than it's ever been, and also to help the white race. And that means that I don't tie onto the conservative movement or the liberal movement or the socialists or the capitalists. We pick and choose, eclectic. And we're not tied to any of these things. Gee, you're awfully quiet. I believe that the information that is available will show that in general, as Dr. Shockley says, in general, the white Caucasian race of people are superior in the sense of creative abilities and IQ and so forth. Now, I go along with Dr. Shockley that there is, and that is at the top, especially in the top stratum. I believe that there are areas of white society and non-white society where there's a crossover. And I believe that the Asiatic race is right on our heels. They're a very sharp group of people. And I believe that, and there's no hatred involved, that and for some reason in the evolutionary process or however you believe that people got here, somehow the black race in general did not quite make the vote. But there are a lot of very intelligent black people. So I don't like to be put in a corner saying the black race is stupid. And one thing you have to understand is a tremendous amount of black people have large infusions of white blood. You see people like Julian Bond, who is a state senator, I believe, in Georgia. He talks for the black race. Why, he's more white than he's black. And you see a lot of these people who have become very much to the top of the black race, and most of them, if you look closely and study their ancestry, have large infusions of white blood. So you have to take that into consideration. Some of the people that you hear of that are black, look at very closely to tell whether they're black. But people like Marcus Garvey was an exception to the rule. A very black man. And black, just the blackness, has nothing basically to do with it. People keep trying to say, oh, you just judge people by their skin. I mean, that's, of course, an oversimplification. But it's genetics. And in general, the genetics type does have to show itself in the skin in many cases. And Marcus Garvey was the blackest black you ever want to see, and he was probably one of the best things that ever came along for the black race.
This thinking could be put in the environment.
Sure. Obviously, a kid that goes to a school where they don't have good teachers, and they don't have good up-to-date school books, and they don't have the facilities, is going to have a bigger problem than a kid that goes to a school that's got all these things. And a young person who is able to graduate from a Harvard, even though I don't have a lot of respect for some of the people who come out of Harvard, I wonder what they're learning. But there are a lot of good people that come out of Harvard, as opposed to maybe coming out of some lesser college. Yeah, there is that. But what we're saying is the main thing is genetics. Environment is a factor, but it is not the main factor. And I think it's a cruel hoax to play on, in general, the black race. And I see black working people who a lot of times use these things as an excuse. And they feel like they've been left out and they want to go out and burn down the building or something. And because they're told they could become brain surgeons and things, and it's just not possible. And I think that is very cruel of the liberal element that pervade that kind of nonsense. Any more than it is for, I have my level of achievement. And I am not even a college graduate. I'm a high school graduate. And there's a lot of difference between myself and an anthropologist or a brain surgeon who happens to be white. And I don't pretend to. I have my talents. Everyone has their talents in certain areas. Oh, here. I hate to ask a question, but can you describe what you think equality is? Okay, well, all right, now there you go. Now that's not equality, see? What you're saying is, I think what most of us want to say, we believe in equal justice. I believe in equal justice. Rights, I don't like the word rights because it's been used by demagogues so much. I don't believe that there is any right. I believe that the state gives you privileges. Some people say we have inalienable rights of God. Well, God has not shown me that. I haven't talked to him lately. And he hasn't talked to me. So I have no proof he's there. So I believe that every so-called right that we have today was achieved because somebody went out with a sword or a gun or whatever, or just their body and threw it into the breach and gained those things for us. And if we're not willing to do the same thing that forefathers did for us, we're going to lose it all. And so I throw out the idea of right as an abstract word that confuses people. There is no magical right. If a criminal has a big gun and a big club and a big boot, and you're defenseless in your home, and there are no police within 20 miles, if he wants to push in the door and put the boot in your head and shoot your head and take everything you have, you'll say, well, he misdid my rights. You didn't have a right. The only right you had was to defend yourself by having a good watchdog and a gun to protect yourself. The right you have is in your intellect to resist and achieve and overcome. And that is not a right. That is something that was given to you genetically by your forefathers over eons of time through natural selection and through all the great struggles that that went through history. And it has nothing to do with good and evil. A person may have the genes of a great artist in the next generation. There's recent studies on this, scientific magazines, showing that a psychopath and a hero are the same kind of people. It's just one happened to flip one way and one flipped the other way. And it's a hairline they walk between a psychopath that does something, according to our society, bad, or someone who does something our society figures is heroic. So it's in the genetics. And I believe, and in this organization, you're asking me a lot of my personal beliefs. We have many people who disagree on different subjects such as this, as far as religion and so forth. But this is my belief. I believe your immortality is only in your genetics. And unless I have proof of some kind of evidence to show me otherwise, don't talk to me about everlasting life and loving your enemy. I had a gal on the radio show the other day. She said, "Do you love your enemy?" I said, "Of course I don't love my enemy. My enemy doesn't love me." And for people to believe that nonsense is some kind of fat cat crap to put you asleep while somebody picks your pocket. Rich, the very rich, laugh up their sleeves at these concepts, and they push religion all the time because they don't worry about ripping everybody else off, and they're not worried about going to hell. They just want you to believe you're going to hell if you resist it.
That's
sure.
What exactly is your belief?
Well, they just have to present themselves. I don't go around saying, "These are my enemies." My enemy is not of any particular racial stock, because the only problem with the black race is proximity genetically and crossbreed. If it wasn't for that, there'd be no rub between us and black people.
We believe that black people should retain their identity. We believe that white people should retain their identity. And we'll fight to help them in a way to do that. And we do dialogue with black nationalist groups and so forth from time to time. If someone is trying to, through legislation or government fiat, suppress the liberty or the ability through our own intellect to rise to the top in whatever we do, whoever is involved in that is our enemy. Most of our enemies today in the United States are white people. Most of them are white. At the top of our list of opponents in the United States is a strata of white people who have sold out their race for a mess of pottage. They'll sell out any race to make money. And these people have bred a philosophy of equality that some types of religious fanatics have carried out in fervor around the country, actually, who do believe. I believe that fanatical equalitarians really believe what they're saying. I have no doubt of that. Most of the second layer opposition have been given a snow job, and they really believe it. And man, if you don't think so, they get just like Tokamada and want to stamp out all the heretics. They really want to kill me. I want to tell you who my opposition is.